Welcome to the Public Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I'm connecting with current and former public servants, one human and one story at a time. I'm really excited to welcome today's guest for an episode that's a little different than what we've done before. Dr. Abir Abdalami is here as a public servant and as a clinical psychologist to talk with us about the connections that she's seeing between her work on global public health and her observations as a clinician, supporting her fellow USAID colleagues and others through the trauma of losing their jobs. And you know, since we met, we've actually seen several agencies now go through rounds of rifts, and so many federal employees lose their jobs. So Abir, thank you for being here. Welcome to the show. I'm so excited to talk with you today.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited for this conversation.
Me too. So let's start where we always do, back at the beginning. Can you just tell us a little bit about how you grew up and what experiences shaped the way that you think about your work in the world?
Sure. So I'm a clinical psychologist, but the path to getting there was a little bit layered. I was born in Iraq, and during the Gulf War, my family became refugees. We lived in a refugee camp for nearly 3 years in the Middle East before resettling in the United States. And I think that experience has been formative, to say the least. I became quite curious about mental health before I had the language for it, because going through an experience like that, I recognize that some families and individuals were quote unquote resilient, as we would say now, and others were having a harder time with adjustment, connecting with people. And I wanted to know what that's about. I wanted to know what made individuals react that way. And I think the other piece to it is the silence around mental health was really interesting to me. And I didn't realize that until, I guess, my teen years, that there was no conversations around mental health during that experience. And from there, I became quite interested in how people, especially those from marginalized or displaced communities, process trauma, adapt to trauma, and then rebuild after trauma. And I think particularly I became interested in following trauma, not only war trauma, but following trauma. How does that impact somebody's identity? And how does that impact somebody's sense of purpose and belonging? So I think that experience really shaped not only my pursuit of a PhD in clinical psychology, but also in policy and really understanding mental health policy.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And so how did you decide that you wanted to go the direction of policy?
You know, that's a good question. I was seeing quite a few people. So I started in global mental health. And so I knew that policies shape our lives.
Yeah.
Particularly because a policy can kick you out of a country. A policy can create an environment where you can thrive. Policies shape our lives. And I was keenly aware of that working with refugees and refugee community, but also in my personal experience too. And so although I was working on an individual level, I was quite aware of the policy landscape that resulted in individuals' integration. And I wanted to address people's issues more than just the one-on-one that I was seeing them in.
Yeah, so we're talking about scale here. And it's really interesting because later we'll get into talking about being a systems thinker. So I don't want to jump there just yet. But I think you highlighted earlier something that we should really get into a little bit more, which is the impact of having like layers of experience, layers of identity. So first of all, like culturally, there are norms around mental health, and then the experiences that people have with trauma and all the different types of trauma then layer on to their experience of their own mental health and their own journey. So I feel like it makes a lot of sense now that you say that, that someone who's trained in clinical psychology would also end up seeing like the bigger picture on that level. But it's interesting because I don't know a lot of people who have gone there. And so I would love to hear more about your time at USAID and what your work was about there and what the agency's role was in promoting global health services.
Yeah. So the way that I came to USAID was not linear at all. Like I did not know that's the path that I was going to take, other than I was really fascinated by global mental health and international affairs and policy. But I was really lucky in that a lot of my research and my work in my graduate school touched on international policy as well, because working with refugees, you really needed to know comparative policy for the integration of refugees. After completing my postdoctorate, I looked for policy fellowships. And I found the AAAS fellowships and the SPICES fellowships that allowed me to be placed in Senator Maggie Hassan's office, in which I worked on mental health policy domestically. But I fell in love with the possibility of also working on human rights at the international level and mental health at the cross between mental health and human rights. And I found myself completing a fellowship at USAID. And while there, I think everything came in full circle for me. I was able to work as an inclusive development advisor. Then I was the senior mental health advisor. We have a congressional earmark in which, or we had a congressional earmark in which we worked with USAID missions and local communities on strengthening mental health systems in different countries and providing mental health services for those impacted by conflict or trauma. And I think the what I really fell in love with was that we weren't treating symptoms. We were treating systems. And that was such a powerful experience because we were able to break cycles of poverty. We were able to break cycles of violence. We were creating healthier, safer communities. And I think that ultimately benefits the United States. And so I found the work incredibly meaningful. And working at USAID, I also met incredibly passionate people that cared about the world and had values of making the world a better place. And so it really did come full circle for me. I worked in over 20 countries working on inclusive development and mental health. And yeah, it was really transformational for me. Unfortunately, we no longer have that congressional earmark, and unfortunately, there are hundreds of thousands of people that are not no longer receiving mental health services.
Can you tell us a little bit more for people who have not worked in development before? Like, what does that actually look like, including mental health as a priority in development work?
Amazing. So as you can have mental health as a standalone program, or you can have it as an integrated program in different sectors. So that's what that looks like is, working with the Ministry of Health in Liberia and building their capacity, their mental health offices capacity to be able to train workforce on mental health. And so you're increasing the workforce, you're increasing supervision, you're increasing different training opportunities. In other countries, it could be the integration of mental health services within our PEPFAR program so that you can have medication compliance. It could also be indigenous practices for mental health. So, for instance, in Zimbabwe and working with the community on a healing circle so that they're able to process the trauma, the community-based trauma that they've experienced. So, healing happens within a community. What I loved about that work is that we met the community where they're at.
This
And so
is
it looks different.
what we like to talk about in policy circles as context-specific, locally led
Yes.
solutions. And that's what that means,
Absolutely.
right? Like it doesn't help if you import something that doesn't fit the context or is just like at odds with the culture. And so it's also like a two-way learning experience, right?
It's a two-way learning experience. I mean, you're not going to parachute in, and not to say that global mental health doesn't have that problem, but at least the way we try to approach it within USAID is like not to parachute in. We are creating systems. We're working on health strengthening systems, mental health strengthening systems, integrating it within primary care, working with local communities on developing greater access. I mean, the whole point is create systems to increase access to mental health, but that is going to look different in different communities.
And I imagine I'm realizing the further I get in life, I realize a lot of what we do is just kind of a reaction to our childhood and what we experienced then. And so I imagine that having been a child who was living in a refugee camp, you were probably thinking at certain points in your career, like, wow, it would have been so nice if a mental health counselor was available to me and could help me process some of what I was experiencing. Or for some families, the violence of certain systems becomes a part of the family experience and generational trauma is a thing. And so I imagine your own experience really does inform your work and also like infuse it with a serious personal connection.
Yeah. So when I said it definitely you working at AID was a full circle moment because I was able to go into communities and talk to them about their mental health needs that were recently impacted by some form of conflict or some or historical conflict. You know, we worked across the globe in countries that have been impacted by war. And so it really did feel quite personal to me, but that also made me very protective of the community. It made me because it humanizes the communities. And I think the more time you spend in communities, you recognize that a cookie cutter approach is not going to work, or a Western-based approach does not necessarily work all the time. And so I think that lens was very useful for me in being able to create more sustainable programs, right? Because people are not going to, especially for mental health, right? You have to build trust.
Right, and there's stigma
And there's
in many
stigma.
contexts.
Exactly. And for you to actually get people into the office, to get people engaged or wherever that is in the community, you have to start from the ground up. And you also have to humanize them. And these are not just participants, they're not just beneficiaries, they're people.
And this is interesting because you're making me think about an episode that aired a few weeks ago with Wes Rist, where we talked about atrocity prevention, because that was his work at the State Department. And we talked about the fact that, like, the whole premise of atrocity prevention is that hurt people hurt people. So you have to heal communities and address grievances and root causes in order to prevent that cycle from continuing. And we're really just looking at this at different levels and in different scales, but it's really the same thing.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, when you have experienced a tremendous amount of trauma because of war, or of poverty, because I always say poverty is a traumatic experience as well, right? You're going to You may, if the trauma is not processed, it doesn't disappear. It lives within us, right? Everybody's favorite book, right? The Body Keeps the Score. It lives within us and it manifests in quite often unhealthy ways. Now, not to say that people have not used their trauma in a meaningful way, but it is, if unprocessed, unfortunately, it may lend itself to really unhealthy coping, and that could include violence as well, right? Because think about trauma. Trauma in the body is basically like an alarm, right? It's a lack of safety. And when you have a lack of safety in the body, you're going to engage in behaviors to maintain that sense of safety for you. And so that sense of safety could look like no one is going to come near me, or I'm going to fight somebody, or I'm going to engage in violence that can make me feel or my community feel safe. But unfortunately, that contributes to the cycle of violence. And so being able to provide funding and engage in mental health programming is it's great for mental health. I'll say that. But I think working at USAID has made me see that it's really beyond mental health. It's about building safer communities and breaking that intergenerational trauma cycle.
Yeah, and this is exactly where it ties into international security,
Exactly.
because I think sometimes we over-securitize these topics, but in this case, it's really helpful to understand the link between all of the things we're discussing right now and global stability and security and US national security, because if we don't break certain conflict cycles, they are bound to recur, and we've witnessed that. You know, history tells us that like a lot of these cycles recur because we don't address the root causes, and that makes everybody less safe and less secure. And then these communities also end up kind of repeatedly being traumatized. So you have spent many years now working in international development, and you've also helped Yale psychology students learn how to be more effective contributors to health policy. Now you are the founder of Unknotted Mental Health. Congratulations, that's so
Thank
cool.
you.
Tell me
Thank
what you're
you.
doing there and how and why you're kind of zooming to focus more on individuals.
Yeah. So I think, first of all, I just missed working one-on-one with people. And so it was a pleasure to kind of move into the clinical space again. But I wanted to be able to take everything that I've worked on and learned and that layered approach to mental health. And so not only working on the individual level, but also helping teams and organizations address their mental health needs. And that's quite important to me. Because you can work on the individual and we can like treat your anxiety or treat the trauma. But if you're working in a system that isn't great or healthy for you, it may not be the most fruitful in your journey. And so I wanted to work with different entities to be able to address mental health. So that's kind of where the name comes from, Unknotted. I also, with the aftermath of USAID and the federal layoffs, and a lot of the uncertainty around the job scene in Washington, D.C., I wanted to be able to create a space for individuals to process what they are going through and provide mental health support for them during this really difficult and uncertain time. And so I see quite a few people across different agencies, and it's been so, first of all, I'm so privileged that people allow me to go through this process with them. So I'm very grateful. And I love the people that I work with. But it also highlighted a really interesting kind of phenomenon that I was seeing across different individuals who come from different agencies. And I saw this particularly with people I've worked with from USAID. I was seeing like this really unique sense of shame and betrayal that I was trying to make sense of, and it clicked for me that what I am seeing was institutional betrayal, essentially. And institutional betrayal is a, it comes from trauma psychology. It's a psychological term that references the harm that is caused when an institution that you believe in, that you value, that you invested in, that harms you or doesn't protect you. It was incredibly interesting to see the aftermath of the dismantling of USAID because it felt like individuals were not just disappointed, right? It wasn't about disappointment. It was more about an erosion of safety and identity that I thought was fascinating because it's like, well, you lost a job, right? But
But
it
it's
was so much
different.
more. It has a different feel. And so I'm so grateful to be able to work with individuals through that and to help them navigate that, because it does require a very different approach in my opinion, in my clinical opinion, a different approach than just, processing job loss.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we've talked about this a bit in other episodes on the show, what makes a public service career different from some other careers. And I will not try to, separate out different types of public service and say like one is more invested than another, because that's not true. However, I think that particularly with people who have worked at USAID, they are some of the public servants who have put themselves in the greatest danger and made great personal sacrifices that are most often unknown, unseen, and unappreciated. Because unlike with our military, where we're quite aware that they are deploying into conflict and that they're at risk, and so we also kind of pay respect and give our appreciation to the military, rightly so. Well, with people who work for USAID, because there is sort of a general lack of understanding of the work that the agency did, I think that, we have another guest whose episode will air before yours who actually worked in West Africa and contracted malaria and had this whole challenging experience and still went back to her job after that. And there's this level of personal investment and sacrifice that I feel like the sacrifice piece is probably the bit that's tied tightly to the sense of betrayal, in addition to the fact that you also choose this kind of work because it is so enmeshed with your identity. And so then I wonder, what do you think? How do we disentangle the work from our identity? Because really, the agency was the vehicle for practicing your sense of purpose or your mission. And unfortunately, it's not an option now. But that doesn't mean that that's not who you are. How do you separate that?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of the I think the federal employees usually come into this work because they're purpose driven. And I saw that particularly with humanitarian people and development people. You have a set of values and a sense of purpose and wanting to make the world a safer place, wanting to make communities safer. And so you're drawn to the organization because, like you said, it provides a place for you to exercise your values, right? It becomes an opportunity for you to live to that personal drive, purpose that you have. And it is incredibly difficult. Like, I know people who have spent 28 years at the agency before they retired. That's a significant amount of time. And with all its faults, people loved USAID because it provided that space for them. It provided a space to exercise your purpose and your values. Unfortunately, the organization is no longer, but the organization also doesn't take away our values. Our values are our values. And what I usually, when I work with people, I ask them, I want you to remember a time where you felt most alive when you were doing the work. Most alive. You felt like you were absolutely in the present. You were aligned with your sense of purpose, because that to me signals integration of the self. Like, most of, your aspects of your identity have come together. And so when we identify that time for an individual, I usually walk them through like a value exercise. So think of what values were being exercised in that moment. And once you have those values, you identify those values, we start thinking where else, how else we can exercise those values in other places, right? And so doing that actually helps individuals gain a sense of agency, because then you can apply your values to a new community, a new job, a new venture, a new hobby. But you just need to find what those values are and be able to exercise them outside of an organization. And usually that starts the healing process for people, because once you have that agency, healing begins. Once you take your power back and you understand what attracted you to that job and what you were able to gain from that job and what made you feel the most engaged in that job, then you can take your power back.
Yeah, and maybe the solution in the next chapter, maybe you're not going to satisfy all aspects of yourself with one thing, but maybe you're going to have a collection of activities that satisfy those different aspects of you. But it's also interesting because having worked with so many people at USAID, I've noticed that they're very good at shouldering other people's trauma, dealing with other people's trauma. And I imagine that it's really difficult to pivot to now having to process your own stuff when you don't have the opportunity to help other people, because helping others feels really good and it's really healing.
Yeah, and it's part of the job. We're helpers, right? And so we help others. We have been trained to put ourselves to the side to be able to help others. And unfortunately, we're the ones experiencing, I don't like to call it a trauma because not everybody's going to see this as a trauma, but we're experiencing this hardship. We're experiencing this moment in time where we have to pivot. And that is very uncomfortable for people to see themselves as the ones that may need help right now.
Yeah, but I do notice that I think recognizing that it's not an individual experience, but it's happening collectively, I'm noticing like communities pop up, people helping each other, and that's a really nice reaction, I think, to what's happening.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's get into what it means to be a systems thinker, because we talked about this a little bit before, and I love the way that you described it. So what does that mean, and how can it be helpful in this moment?
Yeah. So, I mean, just continuing our conversation about USAID people, we are system thinkers, right? System thinkers are able to step back and see the full landscape, right? Are able to connect the dots. And I think system thinking can be, so we build systems, we build water systems, we build health systems, we strengthen systems, kind of that's the job. And I've been thinking about that as such a strength for the healing process. Particularly because if you're able to step back, then you can really see that healing can not only be an individual process, but it could be a collective process, right? And like you said, there's something magical about people seeing that, well, the system is broken. Unfortunately, I've experienced something in as part of that. But also healing can be a part of a system as well. I have been really loving how people have started processing groups. They started resume writing groups. They've started new businesses and new ventures and initiatives. And to me, that's the strength of being a systems thinker, is to being able to organize. And that can be incredibly healing.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe also through the experience of having to take a beat and process some of what you've gone through, like not just in the recent past, but even there could be for people who have worked for the agency for decades, like there's probably lots of challenging, traumatic, call them what you will, experiences to be processed. Maybe processing them and then needing to create something new also leads to things that are wonderful and may not have happened otherwise.
My favorite book is Frankl's Answers for Meaning. Right, out of really awful things that can happen to us, if we're able to derive meaning and understand the meaning from it, I like to say that we have to be careful what narratives we develop for ourselves, because narratives become our reality. And so being able to examine your own narrative about this process and being able to derive meaning, by the way, when it's processed and we people are ready. I mean, this is a long process to get to that meaning making phase. That is part of the journey of experiencing a hardship and coming out of it, walking through it, trying to understand, how does it fit into my life? This thing happened. How does it fit? What meaning can I make out of it to have it fit and be integrated into the story of me?
Yeah, that's so beautiful. And I'll put you on the spot here, because if you hate this, we can delete it. But what meaning after, a whole career that you've built related to this work, what meaning have you derived from your experience as a child living in a refugee camp where, agency would not be the first word that you think of when you think of that experience? You think of being in an environment in a situation that was way beyond your control and probably your parents' control and so many other people. What meaning have you drawn from that?
There's a couple of meanings. I actually have never answered this before, so thank you for that question. We can process together. After living in a refugee camp and after the war, that's essentially what I meant earlier when I said I was really curious about seeing families that were intact and they were doing well and others were not doing so well. Because essentially, you can either come back not dead or you can come back alive after a trauma. And I think I've always leaned in on coming alive. And I was so curious about people and how they process trauma, but also how do they come back alive? That's an important piece of understanding the human resiliency in it all. But the other piece is, systems can be really harmful, but systems can be really helpful. And so I think the meaning that I've really taken from it is, how do we help people through something awful happening, but how do we make systems more human?
Yeah, that's
And
so
that's,
beautiful.
yeah, how do we make systems more human? And I think in it all, I really wanted to help people after a traumatic event. And so I worked at the PTSD clinic at the VA. I've worked with refugees, different refugees across the board. And I've worked with trauma survivors, all types of trauma survivors. Because I think when you experience trauma, kind of the process of processing it and making meaning out of it and coming back alive is kind of the same for a lot of people.
So then, how do you define resilience, and what do you think are misperceptions about resilience?
How do you define resilience? So, when I see resilience, oftentimes people associate it with kind of surviving, going through a hardship and not breaking. Kind of the phrase of like bend but don't break essentially is resilience. But I actually think resilience is a little bit more complex than that. Particularly, I find that resilience is being able to sit with the pain and know that you can get through it. And so you can grieve and go through the pain and then get to the other side of it,
Rather than avoiding it.
rather than avoiding it. That there are two realities that can exist, and a resilient person can hold two of these realities together. that I am grieving and I am sitting with loss.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I have hope that I'm going to be okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to get through this.
Yeah.
And being able to sit with those two realities, I think is what makes somebody resilient.
And what I love about that definition is that, like, yeah, we're all different. We have different personalities, mm-hmm. different natures, and we react differently to stress.
Mm-hmm.
And resilience can be cultivated. Like, it's not like you just are or you aren't. It's a practice, yeah. mm-hmm. the way that you're describing it. And so you can practice being able to spend more time sitting with discomfort in order to build resilience. I love that.
Yeah.
And I think
it's a skill.
That'll be so helpful to our listeners. And so before we wrap up here, I want to give you a chance just to share any final words or anything that you want the community that we've been speaking to understand or to think about as they move forward.
Yeah. So the thank you, first of all, for having a space like this for all of us to process everything that went down together.
We're trying.
it's incredibly helpful, and I'm sure it's useful for many people. I think everybody is in survival mode right now, from what I gather. And most of us are in survival mode. So it's like, obviously the job market is incredibly competitive right now. People are sending out resumes, trying to find jobs, trying to land on their feet. And I have incredible empathy, deep, deep empathy for individuals and their families and everything that they're going through. And at the same time, to make sure that your mental health is also attended to during this time. So when we're in survival mode, unfortunately, we are reacting from a place of trying to protect ourselves. And so I find that people become quite, you know, black and white in their decision making. They give rush into decisions.
Yeah.
It's not healthy for their bodies. And I just hope that people can hold some space for their mental health and well-being. And that doesn't necessarily go see a therapist. That doesn't mean go see a therapist. But it could also mean I need to connect with people.
Yeah.
And I need to connect with community. And I need to figure out ways to maintain agency and cultivate a life that holds this reality and also respects the grief and the feelings that I have in a place for me to process them.
Yeah.
And so I really hope that folks can have a bit of time to do that for themselves, because I do see the hurt, but I know there's so many people out there that are just trying to get through the day. And I just hope that we can hold some space, not just to get through the day, but to be able to thrive.
Yeah. Yeah. Not just survive, but thrive in the future, even if it takes a little while to get there.
Exactly.
Well, I will share the link to Unknotted in the show notes, because I really want people to check out what you're doing and to be able
Thank
to
you.
Access resources that you're offering. I am so thankful that you're out there. And for anybody who's listening, as you can tell, like, she'd be a great person to talk to also, because she knows what it's like to work in this field. So it's not just theory. You know the challenges. So thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your thoughts, and thank you for the work you're doing, and thank you so much for your service to our country.
Thank you so much for having me. It was lovely. It was lovely to talk to you.
It was my pleasure.
Thanks.